Hello, can you hear me? Wonderful. I am Autumn Brownlee, and I am working actually at Pittsburgh Pastoral Institute, but my site that I work out of is Hot Metal Bridge Faith Community. This is a new program that is paid for by a grant to get people that are doing once a week or once every other week clinical counseling into places with populations that may not have access to counseling services. So when Jeff asked me if I would say a few words about what I do there, I was not thinking it would be a majority of a session. So this is new to me, this new speaking to a bunch of people, so bear with me, please. He wanted me to talk about how we develop a culture of caring, openness, and welcome. I was glad he gave me kind of somewhere to start, because I needed to think about how we have gotten there in the last year and a half. That's how long I've actually been in this role. I have been attending the church for 3.5 years, so I did kind of have a little bit of a thought of the ethos, but I didn't necessarily know what I was stepping into. I wanted to tell you a little bit about where I come from. I am a therapist, but my undergrad was in Christian education and youth ministry, and working in South Carolina, where I went to school for that after moving from Pennsylvania, it was quickly understood for me that I didn't feel equipped to step into a lot of people's lives in the way that they needed. So I pursued a master's in counseling from a school in Seattle, Washington, called the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. Their method was to teach us to understand ourselves first, and also how to bridge the divide between being a therapist and being a pastor. I didn't love my pastoral classes because I felt like I needed all of the training in the clinical, and the pastors felt the same way, that they didn't want to spend their majority of their time doing therapy classes. So the tension that we wrestled with, I feel like, had given me a good foundation for working within a church, because I'm constantly asking Jeff Eddings, which was here the last couple weeks, and most of you know him, he is our pastor, our lead pastor. I'm constantly asking him questions about pastoral care, and we're always in conversation about how best we are in this together. A few of the jobs that I had before moving into this, I took a few years off when I moved here, but I worked at a prison reentry center, which is sometimes people call them halfway houses, for the Seattle-Tacoma area federal prison. And a lot of my work was finding jobs for people in the community, in talking to people in the community and educating them about why actually they would benefit from reentry services. And I also worked at Spruce Street, which was an organization for youth, runaway youth, because in Seattle it is illegal to be homeless as a youth. So if a police officer finds you, instead of putting you into a juvenile detention, they take you to a place like Spruce Street. And what we did was really just assess the need. Why is this person homeless? What is going on in their family? We made sure that we were able to get counseling services if that was what was needed. A lot of them, if there were drug and alcohol needs to be met, it was more of a crisis clinic, get a plan in place before letting this youth go home. And I also worked in a private practice right after my internship with, it was a women's psychotherapy clinic that did a one-year program where people had to sign up that they wanted psychotherapy for at least 1 year. It was a low fee at cost. It didn't matter how much money you made. You could make a lot of money and not want to tell your spouse that you're going to counseling. So we worked with everyone. I saw a lot of people there from a a school called Seattle Pacific University, and it was a Christian school. And so a lot of people that came just were like, how am I doing ministry in this new era? Who am I? And dealing with their own issues. So I feel like that really set the foundation for me to want to work within a church organization as a therapist. My passion is the church. I feel like if I wasn't working in the church, I would be a dime a dozen therapists that you can call. I love working in the system and the ethos of our church. It is not a real cutout model, what I'm doing. I took the job, ironically, when Pittsburgh Pastoral Institute was going through a change of directors. The director that was there is actually my supervisor. His name is Randy. He's wonderful. I asked him, well, what does my job look like? And he said, oh, I don't know. You'll have to figure that out. And I said, I needed to know how to do it. That is actually not my personality, but I felt like that was what it was expected of me when I get a job. You should know how to do it. So I asked the same question to Jeff, and he said, oh, we don't know. So I was in this tension of saying, well, what I'm going to do is, how do I listen well? And if I was sitting with a client, what would they be bringing? And I looked at our organization very much as a living organism, and I said, what is the story that is already going on, and how can I be of help in that? But also, how on very many different levels are people needing to be spoken to? So really, the Kintsugi service, I was already a part of the planning. And this has been such a messy, we're just trying to figure it out. You know, Jeff has talked about the Kintsugi service. So I was already at those meetings. So I already knew that I was working with a bunch of people that were willing to work with me and to grow and let me make mistakes. And I have learned a lot. That's okay. We'll get there. My slides are just because that's what they told me to do. They're not the most groundbreaking slides, so. Okay. Well, anyhow, it just says working with the staff to develop awareness. Okay, and I just had, this is a little bit different, but I just wrote the table up here, and it looks like it's already on the next line, so it's not even helpful. But the four areas that we worked with developing my, sorry, let me start over. I got a little disjointed here. One of the things about working alongside with Jeff, he is a church planter. So he is always looking for ways to meet the needs instead of trying to figure out how the people can come to us. I don't think I would be able to just step into a church that doesn't already have somebody in a working model of organic growth. So I just wanted to say that that has been a wonderful place. There are four places that I feel like I have honed in on as a therapist. Now, at the table is the meal. Now, that meal, we do have meals on Sundays after service, and then the table has a different, not necessarily some overlap, but not all overlap to our community. That is on Tuesday nights and Thursday nights. The door, even though the meal doesn't start till 5:30, that door is open between 3 and 3:30. People can get warm. They can, you know, use the restroom. They can play cards. They can be in community with one another. And they know that that meal will be there at 5:30. It is something that we try to have the meal exactly at the same time every day so that no one feels like they don't know what to expect in that area. As a therapist at the table, I am incredibly blessed to have Dave. Dave will be speaking to you about an organization that has that he has been starting, but he had been really had a great rapport with people experiencing homelessness in the South Side as well as other areas of the city. He has a way of doing a crisis intervention situation that is not really in my skill set as well. And it isn't quite what I came to do anyhow. I will do it. It's just I don't know where to send people as much. So Dave is such a forerunner when it comes to seeing the need of somebody and getting them plugged in. And then when people are plugged in, sometimes we have, you know, women that find themselves needing pregnancy services or things like that. I'm able to come in and just say, how is this with you? How are you in this transition? And so I find my way at the table is to work with people that are experiencing homelessness. But we also have another category of people that are older folks, some of them in their 70s, and they are making ends meet by coming to our meal. And they also have some physical ailments, can't walk and things like that. And those are tend to be some of my regular clients that I at least have to check in with each week. So that is not a typical therapeutic encounter. Sometimes I sit at the table, and the first thing is I can ask them how they are, but they want to know if my kids are healthy, if, you know, what's going on, pictures of the baby. I have a three-month-old. And that, in that space, I found that is just something that's different than a private practice and that it's needed. And I'm okay to be give part of myself to them in a way that is actually very life-giving to me as well. So there's kind of my work at the table and with people there. We also have some of my work with the congregation, and it is mixed, but I do want to say that there are many people in our congregation that haven't ever experienced a place where they can reach out if they have a death in the family or something like that. A lot of people in our congregation, a lot of people in our congregation that have had those things, people that come to our church sometimes are in helping professions, or they are people that are already out in the world that sometimes, it's actually called vicarious trauma. Sometimes people can hold so much in their workplace that they hear other people's stories, and then they become, those stories affect them. And so I have been able to provide a space for people to sit with me and give me some of that, as well as, like, let's work on some self-care and how are we going to live alongside people. So that's been a work that we've been doing. I also, there are some people that have been traumatized by church experiences that are now finding a home at Hot Metal Bridge. So we do talk a lot about, like, what is past church stuff and how are they reintegrating into a church of accepting them. So that's another part of my work. Really, I have like 4 slides, so it's okay if they're not working out as well. Let me see. Okay. And then the last group of people that I didn't understand that I would be sitting with as much is the staff. We have sat together and had instances come up. If it wasn't for the staff meeting, we wouldn't know what was going on with Dave, and he had interactions, and Jeff and I, and we come together and say how best I may know something clinically about someone, but Dave has had this relationship with them. And so how do I work with his data of the person as well as ours? That's one way that I can kind of say, this person doesn't feel very comfortable for me right now. I see displaying behaviors that maybe in a week to a month to a few months may be a potential danger for our community. I do want to preface that people that are homeless are generally not dangerous. That is a stereotype that is actually unfounded most of the time. But people that have mental health disorders that can escalate with some types of psychosis or manic or anger, sometimes they find themselves homeless because of their way of being in the world. And so we have to be careful that we are creating a safe space not only for everyone to feel comfortable and accepted, but the people in our congregation. So if somebody comes in and they're showing displays of behaviors that may feel scary to someone in the community, we have to make sure that we are in dialogue and figuring out what's best for everyone. So that is what I've been doing along with the staff. And I can talk a little bit about how we go. Yeah, this one's just a little short. That's fine. All it says is, how do we create a safe space for congregation and staff to engage? The ways that I have done that, just several. I was saying that there are sometimes we have experiences. Now, I will share experiences in a blurred enough way that they're not identifiable. We did have several people this year that had presented somebody that had been in the community. Not any issue, maybe someone on the autism spectrum that had come all the time, been part of the community, been a helper, been able to do those things. Well, this person also struggled with some schizophrenia, and they weren't always experiencing these circumstances, but whatever had led to feeling this again might have been addiction, things like that, had brought this person to a place where they were feeling escalated to me. I didn't feel comfortable. And at that time, what I needed to really say was, is this about me? Is this about my stuff? Am I the one that's uncomfortable right now? Or is this about them? It's never one. It's always somewhere in the middle. Somewhere for me, I tend to be I need to make sure physically safety. I could be like a safety patrol or, you know, check your kitchen for all of the knobs. So I know that I tend to run a little bit, you know, on that end. But this is a person that I was able to dialogue with my supervisor about and say, hey, I'm concerned. I was kind of new on staff and I felt shy about bringing my experience, but I did anyways. And it was good because instead of waiting until it exceeded what we had the tools in our tool bag. We were able to say, you know, when someone from staff said, I had this interaction and I tried to speak logic to this person, I was able to say, well, in a clinical way, we need to step back from that and just hear the experience and not try to rationalize with people that become escalated when we try to rationalize what they're saying. It doesn't matter. They need to be heard on whatever level, even if it's not accurate. So we were having to come to a place where it was pretty clear that we needed to say, we will always be here for you, but right now some people are feeling unsafe. So we were wondering how we can still support you, but you step back from the community a little. And that was a tricky time, but we, you know, Jeff prayed every week on how are we going to step into that. We talked it. I mean, Dave helped us really say, this is a place where I haven't known him. And he had the longest relationship with this young man. And so we were able to say, okay, there is something different about this time and space. It doesn't mean that this person is now voted off the island. It just means, how do we make that place safe? So we've done that. And then just little things like physically. Southside has changed tremendously, and our community isn't necessarily dangerous, but there are places that, you know, people are looking for doors to be open, things like that. So we just started protocol that where the kids meet, they go outside and up these steps. We have a lock there. Just things that we have put in place that I've suggested, hey, maybe let's do that. And now we'll talk a little bit about an emotional safe space. One of the things that Jeff talked about, people being really drawn to our church, is that we have a very welcoming prayer time, that we can be thankful for things and pray for things that are going on in people's lives. And sometimes that is somebody has lost somebody to addiction, or somebody has struggled in their own way, or had been sexually assaulted. And I am wanting that space to be there. But I was the person that was like, we need these children out of this space. And this was when, right when I started the job, but it was more of a congregation person. I'm like, oh, this is getting to be a space where we need to move the kids out. They have their own prayer time. We don't want to take our children out of an experience where they're understanding how somebody is experiencing homelessness, but we don't want to traumatize them. And so we've done that as an emotionally safe space for both the congregation as well as the kids. There are also places that I have stepped into as a therapist when we have our Kintsugi service. One of the elements of the Kintsugi service is somebody shares like a testimony or a time where they have felt that they have gone through something. I was able to share about the time that I was depressed, moving to Pittsburgh after having my first daughter, and that was as a congregation member. It was before I was the therapist there, and I think that that was meaningful to my time here as well. One of the things that we have talked about is how do we share our stories in a way that are vulnerable, but also where we are telling it from a place of kindness to ourselves. Because if we are telling this story and we're telling it in a way where we're harming ourselves or having a lot of self-contempt or shame, that can really, people can feel that in the service. And that becomes too much for them. If somebody is telling a story of a time of their life where they were feeling suicidal, it needs to be done in a way that is emotionally safe for people to hear. And that is a conversation that we've had too, which might be hard to fathom that that's, we have to rein in as well as allow people to share in that space. And so that is a way that we are able to say, how is this story metabolized enough so that we can tell it? But we don't want to lose the vulnerability, and we don't have to be out of our stories. We encourage a story that we don't have an answer to, because that is not what we're looking for. So those are some other places. Can you tell me what time it is?
It is quarter after.
Okay, great. So that is another way that we have accommodated some of the emotional safety. Let's see if I have another slide. Do I have another slide? Probably in just a minute. I did say that sometimes we meet people at their physical space. I do have an office. It's up a flight of stairs. That doesn't work for most of the people at the table. So what I do is I just meet with them in the nursery, because that's fine. And we have a door, and there's, it's enough where people can meet in the nursery, and it's not a big deal. There's also a woman that I meet with, and she's pretty open about her story, but she comes to the table, and she is in her 70s, and she grew up in an orphanage, and she doesn't know how to read. And her stories, she hasn't told stories like this in years, and she will tell me stories, but she'll tell the people that sit at her table these stories, and I hold them, and even though I'm not necessarily the direct link, it's just not me and her, how can I, see her story in a way that is helpful for her? And one of the things over these last years of meeting with her that I have felt really pressed into is her resiliency. She left an orphanage, and she worked for her whole life at a huge organization in Pittsburgh, and retired, has stocks in the company, And she has raised an amazing daughter that has her master's and is running a nursing program at a local place. And I think about the way in which she has moved through this world. And yet, for some reason, a year and a half ago, the only thing she could see was, I just can't read. I can't read. And now I feel like she can see all of the things that are her and not just this one area that has been a really difficult thing for her in her life. So I am almost finished, and then we get to talk to Dave. So this is, honestly, let me just double check here. A lot of times the needs for people with homeless that are experiencing homelessness that hear about our place, or some of these needs are very immediate. So Dave is like, I have a care closet. We had people donate tents. We have had people, their tents be destroyed. And we have been able to get some of those people into housing, and it has been wonderful. And it's been great. The level of crisis is inevitable. The vision of where I work, like I said, was that people can get intimate therapeutic relationships beyond crisis needs as well. And now there is this Maslow hierarchy of needs. Sometimes people need certain things, and I do believe that that's true. But I also come from a different mindset that I think in the here and now, when we have a meal, people can, you know, feel a little safe. They don't need every single need met for us to be listeners. And sometimes in those spaces, that's where you meet someone. We can't do all the things, but we can sit and we can bear witness and we can hear and let them impact us and not get so swept up on how we're going to get this person, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, because sometimes they just need somebody to hear, I'm weary. I'm really weary. And so I think that that is something that I am trying to do. And of course, you know, I have all the other helps in place. So let me just see what else I'd like to share really quick. One of the community areas, I'm just going to try to leave some of this addiction and homelessness so that you can really talk about it from his experience. I am trying to do short-term psychotherapy with people that are willing to do that and want to do that. And some of them, some are people that are not homeless, so there is a type of person that is needing to say, I can't get past this. I'm living in a crisis situation in my life, even though I have housing or even though things look stable. So I'm trying to also give those helps. And I think I'm going to just talk a little bit about some of the things that I do work from. I do think about people as their stories and what they've gone through. I think particularly there is a model called family systems that I think I have had in my tool bag, but I do think about even more now that I'm working alongside the church, because the whole church in and of itself works like a system, like a family system. And when certain people in the community change or change roles, the whole system adapts. And so with staff changes, I want to be really aware of how that will affect other staff, but how the congregation is experienced. And we are going through another staff change, which has been a couple since I've been there, but not the main pastors. The only change is that they are going to be working half-time versus full. So I have to be aware that people may not realize what that loss looks like. And so to be able to take our community, our staff, our volunteers through kind of a knowing of what does that feel like for somebody to want to step into something but not have the time. Like, how can we grieve that as a community? So I'm just going to be doing that for the next little while, and that's kind of what I do at Hot Metal Bridge. And we can take questions at the end, but I thought it would be wonderful if you heard from Dave. He works at our church. He also has this amazing organization that I am not even going to try to describe because he will do a wonderful job. Thank you.
I got this one. This will do. I can hold mine. Thank you, Autumn. Yeah, go ahead and bring up the webpage. So, I said before, my name is Dave Letrick. I have an organization called Bridge to the Mountains. It's an organization that started about a year ago, almost exactly on paper. In theory, it started about 2 years ago. I work in the city streets of Pittsburgh, and I work with the homeless population. I'll give you a brief history of how things got started. It was the summer of 2016, and I was in the south side of Pittsburgh working at Hot Metal Bridge Faith Community as a seminary intern. And I was introduced to a large homeless population there, and I began to minister to them in the streets and in the homeless camps. And I started to notice that we were having some really great conversations about a lot of things that bothered them in life and that they were challenged with. And I started to recognize that a change of environment might create a greater opportunity to have greater conversations. So it started with a couple bike trips where I took three people and four bicycles, and we went to Ohio Powell and we rode the river trail. And it was a wonderful experience. It was wonderful for them to be able to get out from the hardship of being in the city for even a brief period of time, to get out into nature. And if you've ever been to Ohio Powell, you know that how bold everything is there. The rocks, the river, the mountains, the trees. It's God's creation on steroids, pretty much. So that was fantastic, and it really did start to increase a depth of relationship with these individuals and open up avenues of communication that never could have been there if I was on their turf and their terms in the streets and under the bridges. So I did this a couple of times, and then one of the individuals who was homeless, who was on the streets, and I decided that we were going to put together a whitewater rafting trip. So we did that, and we took 20 people whitewater rafting. But when we did it, we didn't take 20 homeless people. We took 10 people from the streets, and we took 10 people with organizations in the city of Pittsburgh that ministered to the needs of homeless people on a regular basis. And we broke the rafts up so that each raft had an equal number of homeless people and an equal number of outreach providers. And the whole idea was the raft was God's equalizer. We are all equal in the eyes of God. And we can be reminded of that when we're put into a situation that we don't know, that we don't understand, and that has some element of risk to it, where we have to do something and we have to work together. And it's a beautiful thing at times when someone who relies on somebody else almost on a daily basis to meet their needs in the street is the person that is pulling the weight, that is carrying the load for the person who meets their need in the streets when they're in the raft. And it becomes a role reversal. And it does wonderful things in the relationships that we have with the people, not only the people that are in the street, but those of us to minister to the individuals in the street with our relationships with each other. The team building side of it is fantastic. So this all was a bit of a just openness to let God guide me where he wanted me. And then about a year ago, a little over a year ago, God very bluntly, very boldly turned my direction here full time. Long story short, I'm finishing seminary this year. I was fairly certain that God was calling me to international mission, and I was preparing for a grant that I was going to travel Africa through three different countries over 3 months. And God sort of very, very blatantly told me, that's not where your calling is. I need you here in the streets. And from that point forward, I started Bridge to the Mountains. And in May of last year, we became incorporated in the state of Pennsylvania as a PA nonprofit corporation. And for those of you who have ever tried this process, you know how much God moved this. Within 30 days, we had 501c3 status with the IRS, which is pretty unbelievable. And we put together a board of fantastic individuals. We continued through the summer to ramp things up and to do more trips to the mountains and to do more raft trips. I also started to become more and more involved in the city with the city organizations that are out there in the streets. And today, I spend a tremendous amount of time coordinating with the other service providers, including Allegheny County, including the mayor's office, including Pittsburgh Mercy and Operation Safety Net. Every Tuesday at 2 o'clock, we have a closed-door meeting at Pittsburgh Mercy with all of the service providers who are in the streets servicing individuals, and we literally have a spreadsheet that we go down through, and we talk about every single homeless person that's in the city of Pittsburgh. And we establish what their status is. We establish what their need is. We establish where they are in the housing programs, whether or not they need to connect with so-and-so, with whoever it might be. And it's a collective effort where we all work together to make sure that their needs are met. And we've been very successful over the course of the past year. I think we housed 40 people. And right now we're tracking about 150 in the city. And that population will nearly double in the summertime as the transient population starts to come into the city. That's what Bridge to the Mountains, that's how it got started. That's what we do. That's what I do on a regular basis. My role is absolutely pastoral care to the streets. There are a lot of people that provide medical care. There are a lot of people that provide housing care. There are a lot of people that provide a lot of different needs, provide food, clothing, so on and so forth. I can do that. I can get people aligned with that stuff. Pastoral care is where God and the people in the streets call me the most. I find overwhelmingly that the people that I'm working with are desperately in need of somebody that can just hear their story and know them for who they are and know about their life and know about the traumas in their life, know about the hurts, know about what their aspirations are, know about what their dreams were that were crushed or what their dreams are that they still intend to find a way to get through. Many of them are struggling with addiction. I have seen massive, massive amounts of drug use. Alcohol is a horrific drug in the streets. It's you know, we talk a lot about heroin and opioids, and I have an extremely large number of people that are using opioids. Meth is also a major problem in the city of Pittsburgh that we don't hear about in the news. It tends to still be a Midwest drug or a West Coast drug, but it is not. It has a presence in Pittsburgh. It is problematic. Alcohol causes a lot of problems. Alcohol makes people do a lot of bad things that they otherwise wouldn't do without it. But what I'm finding is getting beyond the shock of intravenous drug use, the shock of somebody putting a needle in their arm, the shock of knowing that they have wrecked their lives and everyone else's lives with addiction, and they are now on the street. Getting beyond that and getting through that and seeing the person on the other side of it and addressing the person first and not the addiction can do some wonderful things in the lives of people. The addict wears that addict badge to everyone who wants to help them. So when they see them, the very first thing that they want to do is they want to address the addiction. Let's take care of this addiction. Let's get this out of the way. And then we can begin to work on these other things. And it usually doesn't work. And it hasn't worked to this point in their lives. And that's how they got there. When we take a look at the things that are behind the addiction, we take a look at the things that have led people to this space first. And we just say, okay, we'll take care of that addiction later. Let's talk about why are you hurting? How did you get here? People respond very well to that, very well to it. And we can start to address these things. And when we start to address where the sources come from, when the sources become eased, suddenly the addiction doesn't have necessarily the hold that it once did. The most important thing, though, that I can say is we cannot let ourselves, those of us who are in the streets, who work with this population on a regular basis, we cannot let ourselves measure our worth of what we do by the outcomes that it produces. God calls me to be present. God calls me to be there and to be present and to let the space there for God to do the work, not me. So if I spend a year working with somebody who is in the streets and who's addiction, and a year later they're still in the streets and they're still addicted, I can't get frustrated. I can't say I'm not doing this or I'm not doing that. I'm doing exactly what God calls me to do, and I'm leaving the space for God to do the work that needs to be done. And I think more than anything, that's the greatest lesson that I've learned over the past year. And I've learned it's a lightning speed at which the learning has come to me over the past year. I've been taught so much by the people that I've met out there, some of the most wonderful souls you could ever get to know. So that's what I do. We're a little past our 10:30. Is that typically when we move into our question and answer period? So, for either one of us, does anybody have any questions? Yes. I don't have many. I have $1,300 in a checking account that came through PayPal donations. I'm finishing term 2 of 3. We're trimesters at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. This is the heaviest course load that I have ever had in my career. I graduate in May. Next term is going to ease up. I hope to pursue funding over the course of next term. I believe that this is where God's calling me. I just haven't figured out how to support myself through it yet. God will figure that out. That's it. Right. Exactly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that you have the freedom not to have to be tied into that, but obviously funding is an issue.
Right.
So government funding probably doesn't appeal to you based on the results required.
Exactly.
You're looking at churches and
churches, especially churches that, you know, again, I really believe that my call is pastoral care in the streets. It's prophetic pastoral call in the streets. Churches are going to understand that more than nonprofit funding, grant funding organizations. Private trusts, though, are definitely a possible source for me. There's a grant funders database that is at Carnegie Library of Oakland. I have access to it. And just an initial query based on what we do, there's about like 300 different possible organizations that I can write grant proposals to. And so I'm just going to fire out as many grant proposals as I can, try and establish some relationships. The good thing is it's not an expensive ministry to maintain. It doesn't have a structure and overhead. I think that you're right. It is a when you look in the addiction field, it is a performance-based. I'm going to try and defer away from those performance-based criteria, primarily because I am frontline. So I'm not going to take that person all the way through into recovery. I'm going to identify the person that is in the greatest amount of need. I'm going to identify when that person has a window in their addiction that they are willing to try something different, and I'm going to get them aligned with somebody that can pick up the ball and carry it from there. The biggest thing that I've realized is I cannot keep going. I cannot hold on to these relationships once they're off of the front line, once they get housed, once they get into a recovery program, somebody else has to pick it up. Emotionally, time, I can't be there. There's other people that are on the front lines, that are in the streets, that are in greater immediate need, that I have to let those people go to somebody else. Yes. Yeah. I believe I am, yes. And you know, one of the people that I work closely with is a guy by the name of Dr. Jim Withers. And Jim started Operation Safety Net. He's sort of a forerunner in the United States in street medicine. And he goes all over the world speaking about it. You know, and Jim has encouraged me an awful lot because he's recognized the effect that the pastoral care aspect of my ministry has had in the streets. And so aligning closely with people like Jim that I can learn from, but that can also connect me with the resources in the city that can help the people most is absolutely, you know, a critical part, I believe, of my calling and what I'm doing. Yes? Oh, yes.
I think that must have been really a very special occasion for those on the streets.
Yeah, keep talking. I'm just going to show you. I'm going to click to a different page so you guys can see some pictures of that.
I was wondering if you do that on a regular basis or just occasionally, or do you do different things like this?
So we're looking to expand what we do. There, you can see a little bit. We're looking to expand what we do. We're adding, there are a couple of camps. Ligonier Camp and Conference Center in Ligonier, Pennsylvania, is primarily a youth camp. But they have high ropes courses. They have a lake there with a jet ski and tubing. And Patrick Myers, that is director of Ligonier Camp and Conference Center, and I have had some conversations about providing more mountain adventure opportunities other than the whitewater rafting, other than the biking. We also swim at the natural water slides. A lot of times, too, just finding a rock with a picnic blanket and having a picnic lunch along the river is great. Chemawnville in Uniontown also has an indoor rock wall, and they have some. There's a quarry nearby where they have fixed mounting points where people can do rock climbing, and they have the harnesses, and they have the shoes, and so on and so forth. So these are all conversations that are taking place right now in different ways to expand into more areas to create more experiences. The important thing is to remember that those experiences are meant to create the different environment, but if we don't take the opportunity to engage the relationship that that opportunity creates, we're really not serving God's purpose for us. We're not out to just give somebody something that they might otherwise have. We're out to find ways to get space for God to move in people's lives, including our own. Yes. It's really challenging. So we have a couple different locations throughout the city of Pittsburgh. We have a Howard Street camp that is in the north side, and we have couples of 7th Street camp in the south side that we are working. We made some attempts last year to do this, and we're looking to formalize it this year, that we will make those transitional camps for the city. Transitional camps will be overseen and coordinated with the county, with the city, and with Operation Safety Net, Pittsburgh Mercy. And those camps will be for individuals who are in the process of obtaining housing, who are in the process of getting off of the streets, that gives them a safe space that they can be in. We're trying to create controlled areas. We're having some challenges in establishing how we can control who is and isn't in that space. It becomes, obviously, there are some legal issues if we have a transitional camp and somebody is in charge of it and there's drug activity there and there's an overdose there, if there's a sexual assault there. There's a lot of stuff we're trying to iron out. Outside of those camps, the areas in the rest of the city, when you know, in the area, the time that you're talking about is 2 years ago, there were a lot of homeless people that were down along the Southside River Trail, and the city came through and moved them out. The city did try and work with us to engage those individuals and get them moved to other locations. The problem was we didn't have anywhere to put them. At that time, we didn't have the transitional camps. And the transitional camps have come about in a large part because of that. But they also create another problem. When police officers know that we have transitional camps, we've had them, this last summer, we had a lot of them taking every homeless person that they found and saying, you need to go here, this is where you're allowed to be. And they overload the camp with people who are not in transition, who are just homeless. And too many homeless people in the same box is not a good thing. It just creates bad situations. So what we do is once a month, we have a meeting that is more than the weekly meeting that we have. We have a meeting that includes all the city resources. It includes the mayor's office. It includes the chief of police. It includes EMS. It includes major business owners. It is an open forum meeting to the public, where we talk about the homeless population, we talk about programs in the city, we talk about how it's affecting different areas and different communities, and we try and work together to try and find solutions that are going to best help everybody that's involved. Yeah? I work with Sally, who just left the mayor's office recently. She thinks she's still involved with the mayor's office, but she is now heading up Big Berg. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Big Berg app. She's now director of Big Berg. Majority of the work that I personally do with the mayor's office is they have a mayor's hotline where they will get information from citizens. And when there are there's a new homeless person that's seen camping somewhere here or there, she engages me to go out and assess where that person is, who that person is, so on and so forth, and try and get them relocated if it's a problem where they're located.
Is there anybody else doing what you're focused on?
Directly on, I don't think there's anybody else doing, there's nobody else doing exactly what I'm doing. There is another organization that, I believe it's a church, that was doing some river kayaking things on occasion, but it wasn't formalized as far as the mountain adventure goes. When it comes to the street, when it comes to the pastoral care in the street, there are a lot of people that are getting close, but not exactly the same. And Dean Robinson actually is the closest thing to it. He works with Light of Life, and he's on my board of directors. Dean's a recovering heroin addict. He's African-American. You know, the population that I work best with tends to be just tends to be white, between the ages of 20, and most of them are between the ages of 20 and 40. Dean does well with older populations, 50 plus, African American. You know, we just sort of work together and fall into our groove.
Step in real quick. I am aware that we are done with our time here. I just wanted to let you know, I really appreciated just listening to what we're doing. I think, will you be here if some people have some extra questions? You know, at the end, I know that you guys are trying to get to church, but I really appreciate just you listening to what we've been doing. I actually have some clients in Southside this afternoon that I have to get to, so I apologize, I'll have to buzz out, but I will be back next week. So if anyone has a question about therapeutic services and how that works, but Dave will definitely be here to answer all the adventurous questions that we have. So I thank you so much. Here, I'm going to give this back to Dave.